This is Soundings. I'm Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. Soundings now presents the fifth segment in its series on cultural and aesthetic modernism. My guest is William Barrett, a scholar at the National Humanities Center and a professor of philosophy at New York University. Mr. Barrett is widely known for his book on existentialism, Irrational Man. In 1982, he published a book called The Truants, a critical but affectionate reminiscence of his tenure as an editor at the Partisan Review in New York. The Truants looks back to an intellectual circle that included Philip Rov and William Phillips, co-editors of the Partisan Review, and other writers and social critics active at the end of World War II. My conversation with Professor Barrett begins with his comments on what he terms the two M's, Marxism and modernism, both of which went to the heart of the complex connections between Russian communism and American intellectuals in the 1940s.
In this group of intellectuals that, whose fortunes I was following, the first phase of their attack had to be to disillusion other liberals, or liberals generally, in their attachment to the Soviet Union. The fact is, in politics, there's still a religious yearning underneath it very often. People,
what a utopian yearning.
Yes, or that it provides some salvation for the human race. The workers' revolution seemed to have that enchantment. You can see it in the movie recently, Reds.
Yeah. Which is 1982.
Yeah, and it's still that you can tell that the directors, even though there's some minor criticism, he's still enchanted by this notion.
You're talking about liberals, and yet you have liberals and then you have liberals. Right. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, that's a point which actually raised some trouble with readers of the book. It got me into trouble. The thing is, we were fighting a local war that is around New York, but New York was the center of the media, and it was the intellectual center of the country, more so, I think, then even than now. And the two very prominent liberal magazines, The Nation and The New Republic, were all committed to Stalinism in one way or another. And I came in, my co-editors had already been fighting this battle one way or another for years before I entered the scene. I mean, this was a very sizable intellectual influence that these two magazines kind of, and we were referring, therefore, to liberals of a certain group, you see what I mean? Now, unfortunately, what happens is liberals outside of the New York nucleus, which was Stalinized, would tend to get influenced faintly by these views. I consider myself a liberal, and genuine liberalism means that, in my view, your primary political value is liberty. I mean, if you have liberty, within the framework of liberty, you can work tentatively and progressively toward improving things. If you give up liberty for some social scheme which is supposed to promise greater justice, let's say equality, you lose the liberty. I mean, if you think you're giving up the liberty temporarily, which was the case, you know, with many intellectuals who thought that's what's happening in the Soviet Union, you lose the liberty permanently, and you don't get the equality, as we found. And it seems to me that's the great lesson of 20th century politics. And therefore, I want to keep the framework of liberty going. That involves preserving a lot of institutions and so on, because
the preservation of institutions is supposed to be a conservative kind of
approach. Well, if anyone thinks that through, what is required to have liberty in a society?
Continuity.
A good number of conservative elements. I mean, just take this thing of ordinary civility, ordinary moral values. Those have to be passed from one generation to another. You can't have one generation reinventing itself morally. You see what I mean? It's
constants.
Yeah, and to that extent, you know, and in my view, our whole political thinking is really quite confused because we go into sloganeering. I'm a liberal, I'm a conservative, as if the two shouldn't involve each other. You see what I mean? I'll put it another way. It's very hard, and this is perhaps one way of indicating how the truants show their truancy. History at certain periods has very harsh and well, almost evil choices that you have to face. There's some sense in which liberals still in America imagine that it all can be dealt with blandly and nicely. We're facing a period in history when I think it was a very major turn in the road for human beings.
You're talking about right now.
Right now. Because I think the way things are going, it might very well be that the 20th century at its end would be labeled as the totalitarian century. Namely, the century in which totalitarianism virtually took over nearly everything in the globe. The notion, you see, there's not a sufficient appreciation what immense historical labor and evolution went into the forming of what we understand as liberal democracy, what we have as liberal democracy. I mean, that was the work primarily of England. And if you think of the turmoil of British history that was needed to produce it, it's simply amazing. And the idea that is, we take it for granted. But that's a rather sport in the immense centuries of human history. I mean, it seems to me the greatest achievement of the British, and I think we are carrying it along in a fresh and productive way. But it might simply go, be extinguished like a light, and people in the future would know nothing of it. I mean, they'd know faintly of it, but they would not have a sense of it. We've had a good here and comfortable, and there's an American tendency, if it can, not to worry or be mm-hmm. apprehensive.
Yeah, Melville called it fatal American optimism.
Yes. Or also a disposition, I don't want to be bothered. But yeah. History has a way of bothering people at sometimes. Yeah.
Well, you mentioned totalitarianism. You mentioned taking liberal democracy for granted to one degree or another. These are obviously the issues around which this New York Circle gravitated and acted. What were some of the other issues?
Well, we've mentioned art and literature. You see, the warfare then was to establish, at least on our part, was to justify the experiments of modern art. We said the artist, if he is free as an artist, has a right to be as difficult as he pleases, if he can bring it off. You know, I put it as difficult as he pleases and as the limit of his talent makes possible.
Well, who's to judge this?
Well, eventually, people who look at art, look at pictures, read books, and so on. It's the standard test of time.
It's a consensus kind of thing. Huh?
Yes. Yes, because that's what it's always been. Who has judged that Shakespeare is a supreme poet? It's just, he stands up. There's some way in which good works of art manage to survive.
Well, modernism then is a kind of a defiance of tradition?
No. I mean, one of the things I try to state in the book is by tracing the artists as I watched them in the 1950s, and then as their experiments succeeded, they won public acclaim, they arrived on the scene, they were taken into the artistic establishment, so to speak. There became a tendency then in the new people pushing up, I'd say a feeling of anything goes, see. And I thought a deterioration of taste and a deterioration in their sense of tradition.
You're talking about the difference between experimentation and anarchy, is that it?
That could be one way of putting it, yes. Yes, because experimentation gains more sense if you have standards against which to test the experiment eventually. Free experimentation means nothing. As in science, if a guy walks in the laboratory and tosses equipment around, nothing comes out. There has to be some guiding idea. You see what I mean?
Will, tell me about Philip Roth at the Partisan Review. What kind of man was he?
Well, first, they should identify the Partisan Review.
Okay.
I mean, not all of our hearers may be aware of its existence. It was what is called a little magazine, not in size, but little means in circulation. Non-commercial, in the sense that a couple of guys, in this case Rav and his then-friend William Phillips, who became a kind of foe later, we were very young men, and they were they were for a while in the Communist Party, broke with it, and they felt there should be a magazine which expressed these ideas they were groping for. And I don't know how they... Oh, well, I do know a little bit about how they got money. Usually you find some guy who has a little bit of money and he helps you to publish this magazine. You pay almost nothing to your contributors because they're honored to be, or because it's a cause. Mm-hmm. But then the amazing thing is how little it costs to put out a magazine in those days. You see what I mean? We're talking about now the mid-1930s, which was the Depression period. And that was even true when I came on the magazine in 1945. So that, you might say, it's a band of idealistic, free adventuring spirits who do this on their own, you see. And they don't expect to make a cent from it. As a matter of fact, eventually, Partisan Review made a little bit of money.
Was that an embarrassment?
No, but, I mean, it was something that he'd never planned for. But that was some years later.
What kind of stuff showed up in Partisan Review?
Well, it was mostly criticism. There'd be articles on politics, articles on literature. They sometimes got some very good short stories, some good poetry, and so on.
I understand that Rav ran it with an iron hand. Is that right?
In a way, yes. He ran it not so much with an iron hand as just by squatting in your path. If you differed from him, you'd have to pick him up and move him out of the way. You just lurch forward. This is what we want to do. But by and large, when I was in it, you know, in ideas and tastes and so on, we were in general agreement. So it wasn't as if there was any forcing there at all. You know, it was just, it was his manner of... I should mention, you know, identifying Partisan Review, that quite a number of a really first-rate writers for the 1930s and 1940s appeared there. For example, T.S. Eliot, when he finally his last great poems of the Four Quartets, he'd sent them to Partisan Review. You see the first, and they were of course published. Or W.H. Auden, the English poet, contributed. James Agee, who wrote a couple of movies, but also wrote some very inspired prose fiction and prose poetry. And of course, one of the great contributions was the opening short story written by this then practically young kid, Delmore Schwartz. So, and they got poems from Wallace Stevens, etc. It was high level, and the contributors, as I said, expected no money, but they wanted to appear here. And the war had ended, of course, that was a big thing. And there was a sense of release, a promise of a new life, and so on. It also meant the opening up of European travel and connection culturally with Europe that had been cut off for some years, not only the years of war, but the few years directly before the war. There were also a good number of refugees who had come to New York, either at the beginning of the war or a few years earlier, and who by this time had become Americanized or were getting into the cultural swim here. One of those particularly that's well known is Hannah Arendt, you know, who was
social critic and historian.
And social philosopher.
Yeah.
And
how did she
General gadfly in intellectual matters and intellectual and political matters.
From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. You're listening to Part 5 in the Center's series of discussions about cultural and aesthetic modernism. My guest is William Barrett, a scholar at the National Humanities Center and a professor of philosophy at New York University. Mr. Barrett has recently published his reminiscence of the intellectual scene in New York in the mid-1940s. His book, The Truants, describes several post-World War II writers and social critics, among them a young German immigrant who later came to prominence through her writing on totalitarian governments. Her name was Hannah Arendt.
Well, she was kind of the quintessence of German culture, but I'm talking about German culture, you know, at its highest level and highest standards. And she was also a very vigorous, vibrant woman, and her presence was felt wherever she was.
Would you call her, in today's lingo, a liberated woman?
Super liberated.
How did she treat these people at the Partisan Review who you mentioned, well, Rav, just sort of squatting in the way, know, and you tough she, to get around?
She treated him, shall I say, with broad irony. And she was one of the few people who could treat him effectively because, for one thing, she was a woman and he would have to backtrack. We still had the residues of a gentleman to that extent in him. But she, her first reactions were, of course, she liked this as a genuinely intellectual element in New York. I mean, this was the stirrings of intellectual.
You mean she didn't expect to find that?
And then she was almost, I think, almost surprised, yeah. I would say at first. And then, of course, the second thing was that she looked down on it in a certain way. But some of them didn't perceive, since she was a polite lady in a way, didn't perceive how thoroughgoing this was. I mean, she had had a thorough German education and so on. I mean, one American intellectual grumbled. She probably reads Homer's Iliad in Greek before breakfast and so on. Not that she was pedantic in any way. And she recognized that a lot of these intellectuals, who were quite bright and brilliant, were nevertheless sort of educated in a scattered way, which sometimes happens, I'm afraid, in American education.
Well, now, what kinds of ideas did she bring with her?
Well, the first thing she brought to us was some knowledge of what existentialism was about.
Well, that's a big word.
Yep, and I think the big word roused quite a stir. A lot of people didn't know what was going on. But you see, right at the end of the war, people were asking, what's cooking in Europe? What's been going on in their thinking during these years we've been cut off from them? And then came this explosion of publicity about a new movement in France, which is called existentialism. And of course, Americans perk up at a big, long word because they think it may contain a new gadget or gimmick for dealing with things.
Well, in a way it did, didn't it?
Not really. It was because actually it turns out it's a big word whose content really deals with some of the age-old simplicities of life. You know, the questions of the individual, of death, of relatedness to other human beings, and so on. I was curious about existentialism, and I had a training. I had been a young teacher, professor of philosophy just before the war, and eventually I went back to it after a few years. And Hannah Arendt wrote the first piece we printed on it. She couldn't write in English, she felt, at that time. I translated from the German. I got to know her. And you see, everybody was asking, what is there that's new at the time? This seemed to be new. And as a matter of fact, it was new, because I remember when I did go back to teaching in the 1950s that I introduced courses at New York University in existentialism and was considered really outlandish and maverick and so on. And now it's become a standard course that's taught in colleges and universities. And, well, that's one of the things she brought to us, the sense of what had been stirring in Europe.
What is this existentialism? Does it mean that man's all alone? What?
It comes down to this, I think. The root of human existence is the individual human.
It doesn't mean
we don't exist as abstractions, always as concrete human selves and so on. And then a lot of things follow from that.
Was it a rebellion against something?
It was originally. It actually started in the 19th century. It was a rebellion against a certain kind of sweeping generalization that appeared in German philosophy under Hegel. And the man who really launched it was this marvelous Dane, Kierkegaard. Mm-hmm. In the end, there is the individual.
How does it come to us in the 1980s? Is it still around as you...
Oh, yeah. Well, it's more or less... institutionalized. It's now, as we do it, it's absorbed as one kind of philosophy, one of the varieties, or one aspect of philosophical thinking.
Is its heyday over with, would you say?
Oh, yeah, it's sort of absorbed back into the mainstream of philosophy. But when things get absorbed back, they nevertheless leave an imprint and change the general point of view. Mm-hmm.
Is existentialism a religion?
No. No philosophy is a religion. But it's, despite one of the high priests of existentialism, French existentialism, Jean-Paul Sartre, it is intrinsically connected with religion and the question of religion, which all religions are concerned with. What, after all, is the meaning of this life I live? Yeah. I have to face myself in some dimension, which is always religious, whether you're a believer or not.
All right, and what's the upshot of that question? Where does existentialism lead you if you ask a question like that?
Well, it leads you back to the old human and moral dilemmas we all face. We're back, as a matter of fact, nothing changes in life. We're back with Job and his doubts. And it is the kind of question on which you can't make progress as scientists make progress on a particular scientific technical problem.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's come back to the Partisan Review and the people that you write about in your book, The Truants. You talk about the susceptibility of liberals to totalitarianism in their search for political and social havens. There's some irony there, isn't there?
Yes, and sometimes some tragedy, too.
Yeah.
But I think underneath it all, it's understandable on two levels. First, of course, the historic level, namely that after the Russian Revolution and during the 1920s, the facts about the Soviet Union were not fully ascertained, what would happening in concentration camps and so on.
In other words, it wasn't viewed as totalitarianism.
No. It was viewed as possibly the beginning of a kind of, well, workers' paradise.
A social revolution.
Not only, well, it was a social revolution one way, but not a beneficent one, as I see it. Mm-hmm. It was really a step toward utopia. And I think the hankering always is, which leads people to embrace that, is simply that if society is rationally managed, you can get rid of all suffering and evil. And that, I think, is really the temptation behind it. If we can, or it almost becomes a kind of incarnation of the technical spirit. All problems can be solved if you manage them correctly. But I doubt that you can remove unhappiness. Of course, this is the lesson of, I think, of religion, that there's a certain amount of suffering which we have to bear patiently in life.
Certain questions that cannot be answered?
Just that the pursuit of happiness is very elusive. Mm-hmm. And then I think you have to realize that the tradition, they all came out of Marxism, if they didn't, Marxism was in the background at the time that the liberals took this tack, and it was really in the 1920s, before my time, but it continued through the 30s. Marxism was in the background forming this thought. Now, the general perspectives of Marx are really quite utopian, and they flow from the kind of mentality that arose with the French Revolution, namely, society can be absolutely transformed. We can transform human nature and so on. I mean,
Now wait a minute. Human nature is not the same thing as society.
Yeah, but now they said that our being is determined by society, and if society is changed, we'll come out as better beings. There's this sensational.
The environment is going to change the substance
right.
of character.
Now, in Trotsky, for example, in one of his books, I've forgotten offhand which one, he remarks, in the socialist, true socialist state of the future, the average man. Get this, the average man will reach the level of a Newton, a Shakespeare, or a Goethe. That's a tall order.
That's a real dreamer.
He always writes, you know, with such an incisive rationality that you think it's really dead on the line fact.
So he was an optimist, but he didn't have a religious element in all of
Except,
this.
Well, I think what you find is that Marxism was a replacement.
For religion.
Yeah, it gives one a total view of reality. Everything fits in. you have a program of action and so on.
One of the things that you point out in your book is that some of the people that you describe in this book, the truants, have this marvelous utopian social vision, and yet in the immediate, in the concrete sense, they have a really kind of low view of human nature.
No.
That's a tough contradiction, isn't
that
it?
That happens. Human nature is full of contradictions in my view. Mm-hmm. Yes, and I mean, as they went around talking about people, they would have really a very critical and negative view of them, and not just carping at individuals, but the tendency was to see human nature as pretty spotted and so on. Of course, in the back of their mind, this would all become transformed into social utopia.
Well, it's kind of ironic that this group of people, so highly individual, so insistent on their own ideas, were willing in the long run, they were just going to sort of surrender themselves to this wonderful, harmonious social utopia.
That, I find, a paradox. It's easy to say, well, if human nature is rotten, it's because it's been produced by a rotten society. I mean, that's how they think. But I think practically the problem, all right, you're going to change the society and you take over. But the people who are managing and taking over the great transformation are themselves rotten at the core. I mean, on the previous assumption. Because one problem we didn't think about then, which since been in my mind very much, the problem of socialism really comes down to this. If you're going to have complete control of the economic organization of a country, and that degree of power is such that it's a temptation not to use it. If you remember James Madison, the primary thing to worry about in government is a monopoly of power by anyone. There's no such thing. Once you have a monopoly of power, it ceases to be benign. The only way you can preserve liberty is to have conflicting power centers, business against labor, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I think Madison was essentially right, and it's borne out, you know, by the history of liberal society.
In this balance.
There's a fatal desire for power in human beings, and when they get it, the power carries them away. The only thing that can keep a society free is that there are opposing power centers, which limit the others and so on. That's irritating for a lot of minds because, you know, it's not perfect and so on. It involves a certain amount of jostling, etc., but not jostling of warfare. And once you have a concentration of power, I just gave the case of, let's say, a socialist economy is going to, you have a central agency that has all the economic power. Well, I don't see, given this tendency, what's to oppose it then from abolishing freedoms everywhere. And this, of course, is what happened in Russia.
William Barrett is a professor of philosophy at New York University and a scholar at the National Humanities Center. His most recent book is The Truants, Adventures Among the Intellectuals. You've been listening to Soundings, conversations originating at the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. This is Wayne Pond. The center would like to hear from you. Send your comments to the National Humanities Center, Post Office Box 12256, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Possible, in part, by a grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities.